We tell ourselves stories in order to live. That is, of course, Joan Didion. It's also a pretty great description of how we make sense of our attempts to make sense of the world. It holds true for money, too. We tell ourselves stories about money to understand how we live, what's important, what choices we make, what we're stuck with. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Throughout this hour, some of our favorite money stories told by the people living them. A bounce music star, a meteorologist, an actress, an inventor. You can always share your money stories with us. Come visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or find us on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're starting today's show in New Orleans, where it's hard to walk a few blocks without hearing music. And music has made so many careers in that city, like Big Frida's. Big Frida was born Freddie Ross, started singing in a Baptist choir as a child, and she's now known as the Queen of Bounce Music, and it has made her famous. Frida took our producer Jenny Ament to the church where she learned to sing, and she starts by defining bounce.
You cannot live here and not know what it is and not know how to do one of the moves or something, you know? Birthday parties, weddings, like they gotta drop a bounce song and the whole party gonna get crunk, you know? That's New Orleans. It's up-tempo, it's heavy bass, it's call and respond. It has a lot to deal with shaking the derriere. I would not say the A word because we're in front of my church, but, you know, of shaking the butt. Gin in my system. I got that gin in my system. Somebody gonna be my victim. Very hilarious. You know my line. You already know. Everybody just falls out for that. Excuse, I don't mean to be rude, but give me that mic. Let me do what I do. You know, just like coming through, like saying how I feel. Let me do what I do. You know, let Frida come through.
Excuse, I don't mean to be rude, but give me that mic. Let me do what I do. Excuse, I don't mean to be rude, but give me that mic. Let Frida come through.
I'm a trendsetter, and I love money, so ideas keep coming to make money, you know? And it gets very complicated because you have so many people that you're trying to feed. More money, more problems, you know? It's so real. I never thought that it would be so many complications at times. You have to learn how to manage your money in this game especially because you never know when there's going to be a rainy day. I have multi things that I'm into. My music just don't. You know, it reached far and beyond. I'm in, you know, all type of movie placements, and I plan on putting my hands in a lot of other things. You know, I have the reality show as well, working on some spinoff shows, you know, executive producer. Being a black entrepreneur who plans on keep on making business moves and keep on making moves to help people and get them into a different position. I also have my own record company, so plan on putting a few artists under my umbrella and to represent them and represent their music. I have a few things that I can fall back on.
Frida, so dangerous, not dangerous, so dangerous, not Frida, so dangerous, not dangerous. She don't need no help, not.
Katrina definitely brought a lot of us together. It was like a reunion. And a lot of people, Katrina was an advantage for them to even get out the city. And then when they come back, be able to do something new and give them a new breath of life. I've done it, you know, a lot of things in my career thus far, especially within the last 6 years. I have made the music grow so far and get the attention nationally that we deserve for bounce music and the culture of New Orleans.
The Queen D! They want her, she want her, he want her, I got him. They want her, she want her, he want her, I got him. They want her, she want her, he want her, I got him. They want her, she want her, he want her. It go yaka 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 yaka.
We're staying with music now, and the story of someone whose job depends on a beat. Will Bensusan is an alternative hip-hop producer and DJ, also known as the Gaslamp Killer. The speed of a beat is particularly important to Will, and if you go to one of his shows, you might notice that the beats of the music are often in sync with the beat of your heart. Coincidence? Nope.
I come in so quiet and so weird that you don't even know it's starting yet, and then I build up from 60 BPM to 100 BPM to 120 if I'm feeling really frisky. But a lot of people won't follow you all the way there. A healthy human heart beats between 60 and 120 beats per minute. So it's kind of ironic that all of the music in the world, besides car alarm sounding techno and dance music that sound like some kind of fire alarm going off in the building, which is higher BPMs, everything else, the best music, in my opinion, in the world is going from 60 to 120 BPMs. I sort my experience using the BPM, and I like to stop whatever party was happening before I showed up. I like to stop that party, and I like to start my own. Something slow around the 60 BPM range to kind of reset everyone. And then we slowly move up to 70, up to 75, up to 80, up to 85, up to 90, 90 to 100, even higher. The beats, the rhythms, not the rappers and the singers and the bands per se, more of the focused beats. That's what it is, the beat scene, you know? And the drums drive those beats. That's where the beats got their popularity. Sometimes, if I don't feel them coming back, then I'll change my mind and I'll drop a sound sample from tons of classic movie moments that really bring people back together when they don't know where they've gone. All of a sudden, I'll play this moment from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where he's quoting, "Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop to look around once in a while,
you could miss it.
And like just dropping that, it gave me goosebumps right now, just describing what it does to the people. I'm trying to keep the rhythm flowing. When people are connected with what I'm doing, it's like church for me. You know, everybody gets in sync with my rhythm. I've made quite a few songs. Some of those songs that I've made, written and produced on my own, have been picked up by Grand Theft Auto 5. A few other places have licensed my music, and I think a lot of DJs are pursuing that now because they're realizing that people get music for free. So you gotta find another way to make money in this business. Out of the blue, Apple Computers called me and said, "Hey man, do you have time for a chat?" I said, "Is this a hoax? Is this a prank? We would like you to be in our commercial to show off what the iPad can do." And I thought it was a joke. But that happened a few months ago. Hope should always stick with you because things do come of it. You know, it's not just that logical adult naysayer in your brain you should be listening to, because the child mind is right a lot.
Will Bensusan is the DJ known as the Gas Lamp Killer. Our last story about money and music this week is from a band that's made it to the big stage, but has trouble letting go of their DIY playbook.
Hey, this is William Cashin.
This is Sam Herring.
And this is Garrett Wilmers.
And we're Future Islands.
I think a big turning point was when we got picked up by a booking agent. That was the first kind of just allegiance in the music industry. We always felt like we were kind of on the outside. We know I booked our shows for about 7 years, and we all just did everything, like, for especially the first like 5 or 6 years, we were, you know, going to Kinko's and making black and white just Xerox copies and cutting them out in the van and burning CDRs. But as soon as we brought on a booking agent, it was like somebody waved a magic wand, and we were just getting like guarantees everywhere we went, which wasn't a lot of money, but it was like a door deal. It was like a prearranged amount of what we would get paid, which is just totally changed the game for us as far as just the kind of money that we were making.
We were pretty far in the red at the end of last year because we pretty much sunk everything into the music, as well as getting hit with 2012 taxes in the middle of producing the album, and we were just like, oh, we forgot about that. We got hit really hard with taxes last year. Our accountant called us in one day, and he's basically like, well, first off, you know, you guys have very high taxes because you made a lot of money last year, a lot more than I expected, because you're an LLC, you're in the highest tax bracket. And I was kind of looking at the guys like, so should we high five? Is that, like, we made it in the highest tax bracket, and we got destroyed. We got destroyed by the U.S. government. Maybe they'll come after us.
They beat us up, and they handed us our wallets. because we did it ourselves for so long, we figured out how to do it very frugally. I feel like we're still, even though we've been in a band and been musicians for so long, like there's a bunch of expenses that I think a lot of bands take for granted and think that they have to pay for, and it ends up being a lot more expensive for a lot of bands. Just like hiring crew before they're ready. I think some bands think that you just have to have a tour manager, you have to have a driver, you have to have... We just sort of took all the roles upon ourselves and cut corners everywhere that we could along the way.
Well, that's because we had to. We've just always done things. We've always worked solely out of necessity with what we could do. And I think that's one of the reasons we've survived as a band, because of that financial edge, you know. The fact that we became a three-piece when we moved to Baltimore, that had a big effect on what we were able to accomplish with the means that we had at our disposal. It's funny because now we're at the point where we're realizing we do need these certain crew members, and we're I'm furiously shaking my head no, like I don't want to do that. But even though it is time to give the reins over, because it's just too much for us now.
We're still super hands on with everything, but I think because it's our baby, like the three of us, you know, have been working on this project for so long with no outside input at all. So now that we have like a team now that we work with, but we're still very involved with every little nitpicky detail.
My problem is that I don't need anything, and I expect a lot. It's kind of like if you're going to be paid for your service, then you've got to do your job, but also I don't need your help. The same. Does that make any sense? Because I mean, that's the reason I do what I do, is because I don't need any overhead. I don't want any hard direction in things like that, because you know that's why I'm an artist, is so I can do what I want to do, basically.
Today, we're letting people tell their own stories about money and moments that changed their lives or made them embrace a new normal. Now, a comedian and his love-hate relationship with debt.
My name is Andy Kindler, and I'm a stand-up comedian slash actor slash writer slash producer. I made up that last title, but let's go with that anyway. I have had problems with money my entire life. When I graduated from college, I drove cross-country in a Ford Country Squire station wagon. When I got out to the West Coast, there were problems with the car. I needed new tires, first of all. That's how they get you in. So I went to the Firestone, and, you know, unlike today, people didn't trust auto mechanics so much. Back in those days, we knew nothing, and they would often show you a piece of your car, and they'd say, "You see that?" And I'd say, "Yeah, you see that? Little ridge?" And I go, "That's good? No, that's bad." So how was I supposed to know? I had no money. I had nothing. Zip. So I had to go for credit. And back then, I couldn't call up Mr. Visa or Bobby American Express. But Firestone had their own. They were happy to extend me credit. And they said, "Free financing. You won't have to pay anything to get out of here." I all of a sudden developed many problems with my car. I had change tires on it immediately. And then, you know what? Maybe there's something wrong with my transmission, they said. Quickly, I had run up $5,000 on my Firestone card, which made the other credit card companies very excited and said, "You look like the kind of person who we're looking for." And that's how I started to get other credit cards. And that's when the really foolish purchases began. I thought you could put things on this plastic card and everything would be fine and there would be no repercussions. And so my philosophy then, which I thought was brilliant, was you pay the minimum amount on these cards. This is how they don't get you. You know, a lot of people pay them off early. I say pay the minimum. In those days, you could pay $12 on $15,000. Now they've tightened up on that. The consequences were that I'd run up my cards to $30,000. $30,000 in debt. But I have gone through a seesaw effect on my credit, up to 80,000 it was up to once. Now it's down in that $28,000 range. What I suggest to people, if you're in debt, is to have a brother who's an investment banker. And that is what I ended up doing. I got more comfortable with the not knowing what's going to happen type thing. I mean, sure, we'd all like to have a Roth IRA or even a non-Jewish form of IRA. I still feel like you have to deficit finance your career. You know, what company doesn't invest at tremendously high interest rates?
Andy Kindler is a stand-up comedian in L.A. We've played a few stories of people building their careers and trying to make it. Now, a story about a job that quite literally followed someone home. Gary Dobbs worked as a meteorologist at ABC's affiliate in Huntsville, Alabama, for 31 years. And in April of 2011, Gary had just gotten home after a long day covering a tornado outbreak. And there were storm warnings still in effect. He lay down to take a nap.
And before I could doze off, I heard our chief say, our radar system has detected a tornado on the ground in Hackleburg and Phil Campbell area of North Alabama. Well, I knew that was exactly southwest of me, so I called. I said, why don't you put me through to the control room? And as this tornado gets close to where I live, because I know it's heading my general direction, I will just report on it for you. So I get on the front porch of my house, and the first thing I see is this huge wall cloud. And it was so massive, it covered the entire skyline from one horizon to the other. And the wall cloud was getting closer and closer and closer to me, but I still didn't see any tornado. And then all of a sudden, the wall cloud parts, and there it is right in front of me, about 100 yards away. And it was at least a mile wide. And it was the ugliest, nastiest thing I've ever seen in my life, staring me in the face with boiling black clouds. The minute I saw it, I said, well, now I see the tornado. It's right in front of me. It's heading straight toward me. So I'm really going to have to go now. And so I threw the phone down. Well, I got to the middle of the house, and then the house started exploding behind me as I was running. The walls exploded outward. The windows were exploding inward. I heard my car hit the roof of the house. I heard the pecan trees hitting the house. The house was literally coming apart on my heels. So I got in the closet. I knelt down. I put my arms over my head. And then in just a couple of 3 seconds, the tornado hit where I was. It sucked me down first into the crawl space and then pulled me up and up and over. I flew over the tornado shelter that I was trying to get to. It put me down in the backyard, and then it started piling the house on top of me. And I got hit by what I say is every piece of lumber and nail in Lawrence County, but at least that's what it felt like. I got hit by the washer on one side. I got hit by the dryer on the other side, which broke my ribs, and everything was gone. Everything was level. My house was gone totally. My neighbor's house was gone. The restaurant next door was gone. All I could see looking any direction was nothing but flat, except with an occasional vehicle that had been blown up into my yard from my neighbors across the pasture. As it turns out, all of my neighbors who were at home at that time were killed. And they were there 1 minute and gone the next. And so it certainly makes you stop and think and appreciate. We had a house full of antique furniture, just all kinds of valuables. This tornado was not like blowing a house over. This was like being hit by a bomb. Everything was in splintered pieces. And so there was really nothing salvageable. So everything from that point on in our lives was substantially downsized to what we felt like we only needed. Before, we had had all this stuff that, you know, was just stuff that was pretty to look at, but it wasn't a necessity of life. So it changes your perspective about things and the value of things.
That tornado changed Gary Dobbs' perspective about the value of things. We wanted to get your perspective on things versus time. And so we asked people in L.A., would you rather live twice as long or have $1 million right now?
Difficult question, man.
$1 million.
$1 million.
$1 million.
$1 million.
I think I will have $1 million now.
Because?
No, because.
It's better to be rich.
Well, buy a house for one thing.
Money is whatever, but to be able to do twice as much stuff in your lifetime would be way better.
No, I still take $1 million now.
Well, long life is meaningful only if you're healthy. But most people, your organs, your body are not designed for you to live 200 years.
If only exactly $1 million, no, I'm not accepting. More than $1 million, yeah, I'm going to take the money.
I don't want to live longer. I want to live as much as healthy I am till I die. And I want to enjoy life. Rich and healthy.
I feel like I'm a very happy man. I'd probably rather live another lifetime.
Well, actually, I choose both.
Both?
Yeah, I mean, if you live a long time without having nothing, what's the purpose of living?
This week, some of our favorite stories about people and their money. Now, a writer and journalist shares the advice she ignored and the advice she kept.
My name is Simran Sethi. I'm a writer currently working on a book on the loss of biodiversity in food. I was born in Germany, and my parents and I immigrated to the United States when I was just a few months old. Then we moved to the South from the D.C. metro area when I was six. And I'm of Indian origin, so we'd go back to India with some frequency. So my upbringing was one that made for a really rich experience. I was always acutely aware from a very young age of the value of money and the value of hard work. You know, my father was born in what's now Pakistan during partition. It was once India and now it's been separated, but he and his family had to walk from Pakistan to India. And his father owned a shop, which meant that they left everything behind. And the route for my father out of poverty was education. So I kid you not that from the age of five, my father was already talking about Ivy League schools, and he was already laying out my professions for me. I would say 99% of the Indians listening to your, you know, program can agree, like, you get five choices. You can be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, a teacher, or somebody involved in religion. It was kind of a repetitive refrain that marks my childhood from ages five to probably, I don't know, 15 or so. You're going to an Ivy League school and you're going to be one of these things. And I had settled on either anesthesiologist or attorney because I think I'd watched a lot of L.A. Law. But what I loved in high school was working in a record store, and I loved music. And when I was in my first year of college, I was offered an internship at MTV News. They were starting a documentary division. So what would have been the first semester of my sophomore year became an internship at MTV News for their documentary division. And my father couldn't make sense of it. At first, he was like, wait, what? Now I wasn't, you know, following the rules, right? Up until this point, I had done my part. You know, I had grown into the woman that he had wanted me to be, and all of a sudden I'm working at MTV. I mean, there are a bunch of, like, women dancing around scantily clad on MTV. Like, what is this? You know, who does this? But there was a flash of pride when he saw my name in the credits. I mean, it's quite a lovely thing to have your parents watch rockumentaries just to see your little name show up at the very bottom in a super small font. I didn't really fit the career mold that my father had created for myself, but I imbue and I live out all the values that he wanted me to kind of manifest within my career. So that sense of responsibility and that sense of accountability has existed in every job I've ever had. Most of my jobs have been freelance, and most haven't come with benefits or pension plans or any of that. But what I have managed to do is save a fair amount of money and really max out the times or take full advantage of the times when I did have a 401k. That is what every single one of those lessons, to save money, to work hard, to plan for the future, have stayed with me now. If I didn't have that financial cushion, I wouldn't be able to do what it is that's important to me and what it is that I love.
Simran Sethi is a journalist, author, and educator. Our next story is about making things and about second chances. She's a denim designer at The Gap. He's a Vietnam War veteran, and together they've built a new business and another life for clothes.
My name is Marlo Fox, and I go by Fox.
Her name's Fox, and
my partner is Jeff
Garza. When I was growing up, my dad, he was an electrician.
Has been an electrician for Edison for almost 30 years.
I mean, he'd wear his Levi's for what they were made for, like, you know, working in it, like, you know, digging holes and climbing up in attics and all kinds of stuff. So he'd wear his jeans until he couldn't wear them anymore, you know, until they're blown out and ripped up. And
he works so hard and has such a positive attitude, and you can see it in his jeans.
My dad doesn't like wasting anything whatsoever, especially his money, because he works hard for it. So he found a way to, you know, get more life out of it still, not just throw it away and make it trash. He'd start cutting the legs off, and he had a crappy little sewing machine and kind of figured out himself how to start sewing them together, you know, and every time he'd mess up another pair of pants, he just...
Every time he used a pair of jeans, he'd sew it together to make this piece of fabric.
Add it to the blanket, and it got pretty big, pretty quick. And when we'd go camping and stuff like that, you know, picnics, the blanket kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger over the years, and then eventually it was a really big blanket. It was just always a fun, like, you know, memory of camping because it's jeans. And
so he shared this blanket that he's been making over the years.
My dad's old idea kind of was like the last spark that gave us the idea to run with it, you know, take his idea and just go crazy with it. And we're at the Foxhole. It's in Silver Lake, California. Yeah, it's my girlfriend's and my store.
Jeff thought of the name. I go by Fox, and he's a veteran, so Foxhole, you know, is something dug that they kind of hide behind.
I don't know, we really, really like jeans. Not really much more to it than that.
And so we met and shared all this and fell madly in love. And
it was a good coincidence when I met my girlfriend, because she's actually works as a denim designer.
I always have been making things, and Jeff has always been collecting things. So we kind of put that together and
just kept saving our money. One day I was walking down the street and I saw this place was for rent, and I called, and the rest is history.
Denim is, in a person's wardrobe, is the only piece that can tell history and personality. People really like holes now. In a mass market consumer trend analysis, destruction, it's called. So if you can find something that's naturally worn in, it's like a treasure, and people come here to find the treasures. We kind of take any utensils that sand. Jeff's a skateboarder, so we'll use the skateboard or any kind of rough surface to make some destructions and kind of test it out and see what looks right and what looks kind of awkward. You know, Jeff does a lot of traveling and finding these things.
You know, I had $20 in my pocket, buy a couple things here and there and stash it up over the years, and a lot of clothes.
Denim pieces.
A lot of denim.
Customized jeans.
A lot of old random cool knickknacks.
Rugs.
Yeah, we have a collecting cool crap problem for sure.
Anything you could think of, we could probably make up for you.
Jeans, you can just throw them on the ground and they take a beating. And
it just continues to get better and better and better. It never gets worse. It
can just be like stitched and fixed back up, and it's, you know, keep reliving some life into it, and
A style that'll be around forever.
I don't think it's ever going to go out of style. People will be wearing jeans forever.
My mom used to call me the cutter because I'd cut everything and make new silhouettes.
For the most part, she's the genius that does all the sewing. It's not like you're going to a mall and you're getting the same thing as everybody else. Like, you have to find something
and you repurpose it. It gives it a new life and an individuality that makes it more valuable to someone else.
You know, take their dad's old jeans and turn them into stuff, or like, you know, shirts that are just beyond wearing that they've been holding on to for 20 years in a drawer. It doesn't do anything. Like, you know, we can sew that onto something or do something with it. So,
but with denim, you can basically rebuild the fabric, and it's this just amazing feeling of life that you can keep giving it, and you can't do that to many things in life, period. So that's why I love it so much.
Here's another story about making stuff and trying to make a living by doing it. I'm talking about manufacturing. Once a solid career without a college degree, now it's less certain. And here's one story from Kenny Reeves. He's been working on and off in manufacturing in the South since he graduated high school in 2007.
You know, all my life I've worked around engines. I built engines. You know, we raced race cars over at the local track, you know, and that's what we did all our lives. So building engines was fun for me. And I probably wouldn't want to be a manufacturer for duct tape or something like that. My name is Kenny Reeves. I'm from Hartsville, Alabama. Right out of high school, I started with a company named ICE, which is Industrial Commercial Electrical. They didn't have no work, so I got laid off. After I went there, I went to a place called the Perry Company, which was an electrical place. Didn't work there long. I only worked there a few weeks because they definitely didn't have no work. I don't understand why they hired me. But after there, I went, can't remember the name, they moved that plant to Mexico. So I went to a place called Copeland, which was in Hartsville. They shut the plant down and moved it to Indianapolis, drawing unemployment in between a bunch of these jobs, too. They focus so much on the jobs that's been brought to Alabama. Like, I know of four or five big plants that's come, but yet we focus on that so much we haven't realized that four or five big plants has left. I mean, the radio host here, we was just talking of losing International Paper in Lawrence County and how it has affected the whole entire county and how the county is just going downhill right now because of it. I went to Toyota after I got laid off from Navistar. They was going to let me in, but they made me go through like a 5 or 6 step process in order to get hired on as a temporary worker. I mean, I had to do a written test. I had to do a computer test. I had to do a field test, a thorough medical exam, and carpal tunnel test and all that. And it took like 3 or 4 weeks. And then at the end of it, I still didn't get on. So I guess there's so many people going after the job now, they really want to dwindle down to make sure they get good workers. I enjoy making things with my hands. And whenever the economy crashed in 08 to 09 to 2010, there was just no jobs. There was no work being done. I mean, there was nothing being built. I mean, nobody had no money to build. So in my perspective right now, manufacturing is a great opportunity. They pay good. You cannot make no more money anywhere else. I mean, they pay the best money there is for someone that don't have a degree. And, you know, they take care of you far as insurance and stuff like that and give you good vacation, good benefits. At Navistar, I was building diesel engines for semi-trucks. Basically, I worked a station or two to put a different parts on the engine when it got to my station. 3 years of my life, you know, I enjoyed doing it. And, I mean, I got a lot of stuff accomplished with the money that I made there. So I've seen the jobs come, but I've also seen the jobs go.
From manufacturing to TV and movies now, people learn to handle money in so many ways, often from our parents. But actress Alicia Witt decided to flip that script and teach her father a lesson about money.
I'm Alicia Witt. I'm an actor and a singer-songwriter. You might have seen me on Justified on FX this past year. I've been doing it since I was 7 years old. I grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts. It's about 50 miles or so west of Boston. My parents were both teachers. My dad made about $35,000 a year, and we didn't have a car until I was, I think, 11. We relied on other people to take us to the grocery store or my other grandparents to take us to piano lessons. Money was always something that we had to be careful of. Despite the fact that my father was working so hard for comparatively so little money, I couldn't believe that my dad kept all of his cash in his back pocket of his pants. He never had a wallet, and I decided to test him once and just kind of teach him a lesson in my childish way. I decided that every day, for as long as I could get away with it, I would go into my dad's bedroom and find his pants where he had thrown them on the floor or changed into another pair of pants, and I would just remove the cash from the back pocket and hide it. And I did this consistently for about 2-3 weeks. My brother and I were laughing about it and wondering at what point they would notice, because we had hundreds of dollars. I wanted to show him that he wasn't keeping track of how much cash he had on him at any given time. Then I walked through the kitchen one day, and my parents were sitting there at the kitchen table talking in hushed tones, very tensely, very upset and confused. They were saying, there's hundreds of dollars missing. I don't know where the money's going. I mean, here's our grocery list. Here's our electricity. I don't know. So my brother and I decided that was the moment to spring into action. I went into my room and took out handfuls of money and just started walking through the kitchen, fanning myself with the cash. And I would like to be able to say that it completely changed the way my dad handled his cash, but he still carries it in his back pocket.
Alicia Witt is an actress and musician. So, some of us learn money lessons from our parents, some teach them, and still others figure things out on their own. That's what James Ellis did before he built a career as a designer. He dropped out of high school in Georgia, moved to New York to look for work, and refused to give up, even when some other people might have.
I'd never been to New York. I mean, really, I had Crocodile Dundee. You know, that was like my main New York City reference. I started reaching out to different companies and stuff and getting nothing. I do find this one company called Olive. The work is great. And then there's this little Easter egg on the site, this little small thing, and it says, Axl Rose, click here. And then it's this open letter to Axl Rose. It was this goofy thing, but I saw that and I was like, that's the company that I'm going to get a job at. I stopped looking around for other jobs. I just quit. And I started inundating this company with emails. I call them a few times, just get nothing. I get machines. I leave messages. I'm probably getting on that like borderline of like weirdo status. I'm getting really desperate. Like at this point, like it's full desperation. I'm running out of money. I have so little money that at this point I've sold everything I have, and now I finally decide like I'm going to sell this family heirloom. I had a 1947 Martin acoustic guitar. It belonged to my grandfather, and he passed it down to me with the strict rule that you are never to sell this guitar ever. And I do not want to fail at this whole moving to New York City thing. You know, especially on the heels of the high school dropout thing. So I decide, you know what, I'm selling it, don't care. That money runs out. I have to find a job. So I write this long letter to Olive. I got to get their attention somehow. I was like, look, I understand if you don't have any jobs, but like I'm just demanding that you meet with me. So I send the letter, radio silence, nothing. Like I'm just checking email all day, like waiting for him to write me back, nothing. Next day, nothing. It's just getting sad. I mean, it's just like, like, I set myself up so that this is the only place I'm going to get a job. And then, like, these people clearly want nothing to do with me. So at this point, I'm kind of giving up, and I'm just applying for anything. And I'm applying for a flower delivery job. And I go on the interview. Yeah, he's only talking to me for like 5 minutes, and he's just like, yo, just get out of here, man. Just get out. I was like, wait, what's wrong? And he's like, no, I'm not hiring you. Just get out. He's like, I can just tell. Just get out. Don't waste my time anymore. You are going to be out of here in 2 weeks. I can't even get a flower delivery job, and I'm walking back down Second Avenue. You know, I walk by the offices of Olive. I'm walking past the Rutherford building, and I notice the security guard is kind of off to the side. He's helping like an older woman with some boxes or something. He's kind of carrying them around. And so I just run, and I go to their door and knock on it. And this guy opens the door and hello. And I was like, do we have an appointment? And this is Steve Fritz. This is the person that I bum rushed.
My reaction was, wow, this kid, he comes up here. He dropped out of high school. He's got the attitude. Like, I love this guy. And he's smart. And you were telling me the things you were doing, and you'd worked at a printing press. And, like, I didn't know anything about the press. I was like, wow, he's really smart. I just like him. I like him. I like to talk to him. I could see working around here and smoking cigarettes with this guy. You know, it was almost that simple. What Jay may not have realized at the time is that we were knocking on doors and we were not getting any answers just to make ourselves laugh. We just said, you know what? Let's write Axl Rose a letter. I think this idea was just born out of desperation, and let's see if this guy will ever write us back. And just for the record, he never did. But
a sense of humor, you know, gets you a very long way. And that and the fearlessness that is born out of total desperation, you know, that is a very powerful thing.
You know why that works, though, is because he was really determined and he was really hardworking. The one thing I learned in running a business and 20 years of working is that there's a lot of luck involved. You're going to get a lucky chance, but it's what you do with that chance.
The same thing that led me to just run past a security guard and, you know, try to go get a job by sneaking into a building. That same desperation is what made me sell this guitar. It was a point of pride that I was going to somehow figure things out on my own at the cost of looking like an idiot or being thrown out of a building or losing a family heirloom. And so I think that period of time, those formative years, you know, that definitely shaped everything that followed for me.
By the way, James Ellis is still in New York. He's a partner at a design firm, and he did manage to get the guitar back. Our last story today is from an inventor who made a machine that turns weather into sound. His name is Quintron, born Robert Rolston. He calls the machine the Weather Warlock, and it takes a series of sensors mounted outside and runs them through a soundboard, turning them into tones. Wind makes a sound, rain, sun, etc. Here's Quintron in Spellcaster Lodge, his home and workshop in New Orleans.
And my latest obsession is this beast that we're standing in front of called the Weather Warlock. So this is an audio mirror of what's happening outside. You could close your eyes and hear the sunset. You could close your eyes and know that it's raining. You could close your eyes and know if it's windy or not. This tone right here is the end of sunset. I'll turn everything else down. And then at that moment when the light just dips just low enough, you'll hear a tone come in. And that tone will descend like 2 octaves into nothing, and that takes 45 minutes. So imagine a pitch going microtone by microtone by microtone by microtone down very evenly over 30 or 40 minutes. You could never even do it with your fingers on a knob. Like, you could never have that precise of control over a descending pitch with anything you could do with your hand. You could program it, I guess, but this is like only the sun can do that. Only this, the descending light of sun can do that. This is the drone that's controlled by temperature. And then this one is the wind, but it's not very windy, so I'm gonna quickly go make the wind go fake. Hold on. So that's the wind, and then the sun, which is almost gone. It's just petering out. It's just ticking, and eventually it'll just go away all night, and then when the sun rises, it'll start with this ticking noise and then ascend in pitch until it becomes too high for human hearing. And then the rain, I'll make it fake rain really quick. I sprayed water on the rain sensors so we can have some rain sounds. And you can change those and slow them down. And I'm playing it right now. Playing with the weather. This is my second good idea I've had in my life. I guess when you're an inventor, you acknowledge those, like, there's small ideas and there's inspirations and then there's like big good ideas. And I would say this is the second big good idea that I've had. And my first inclination was like streamline it, make it, you know, somehow mass producible and sell them. Like, I think people would want these and got to, you know, get the price down, and looked into like manufacturing in China and having the boards burnt here and there. And then slowly I just had to build the biggest, craziest, most complex one that I could. Don't streamline it, put more knobs on it, more twiddles and doodles, and make it just the most ultimate, best, you know, multi-$1,000 crazy analog synth that I can, and then stream it for free. I had to invest a lot of money in trial and error. I had to buy a lot of parts that I ended up not using. I worked with a really important design partner in this, a local engineer named Marshall Brown, and we both spent a lot of time. We were not working other jobs. And mostly the expense was in, you know, our own labor and parts. Thousands of dollars in unused failed experiments. But that's how you improve on things. You build and fail and destroy and build and fail and destroy and build and fail and destroy. That's the history of all invention.
And that's our show for the week. Come visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org. or Marketplace's Facebook page. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're always having conversations there about where life meets money. Go there and join in. You can also call our special Marketplace Weekend voicemail and share your thoughts there. That number is 1-800-648-5114. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament, Raghu Manavalan, and Haley Hirschman, with some help this week from producer Nick White. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.